Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. Calling the case A20-1426, In Re Welfare of Children of BLW, MTL, and TB.
Good morning, and thank you for participating remotely. And although we are not in person, we will proceed under the same rules as if we were in the Judicial Center. The proceedings are being audio recorded, so please state your name and the party that you represent before you begin your argument. In addition, because we are using, as you know, this video conferencing platform, sometimes there are interruptions, pets, doorbells, family members. We understand that those things can happen and hope that we will all work to keep such interruptions to a minimum. If you look in the top right-hand corner, you'll see a way to toggle between active speaker view and gallery view. I say this because the marshal's sharing his screen, and that has a clock for you. And if you're in active speaker view, then all of the screens are really really small, and you might not be able to read what's on the clock. So, but moving into gallery view, you should be able to see how much time is remaining for your argument. I also want to say that if you're not able to hear us or see one of us, let us know right away and we will pause and make sure to that we have a good connection. And only the judges and the attorneys are permitted to speak. So we have disabled the ability of the other participants to share their audio and video or to make comments in the chat function. Are the attorneys prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I did have another question about whether or not there was going to be any splitting of time.
There is not, Your Honor.
Okay. Then we will start with the attorney for the appellants.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll. I am the attorney for appellant C.W. CW requests that this court reverse the district court's order denying her request for adoptive placement and for an evidentiary hearing on that issue and remand this matter for said evidentiary hearing to take place. In addition, I did file a motion to strike portions of respondent guardian ad litem and Min Prairie's brief. I do ask that the court review and grant that motion as well. Your Honors, the briefing contained significant details with regard to the facts of that this case. So I don't plan to address those in detail, except to orient ourselves that this is an appeal from a motion under 260C.607, subdivision 6, wherein CW requested adoptive placement of her niece and nephew. The district court denied that motion, and here we are today. CW contends that the district court erred by conducting a process and making determinations that are outside the scope of what is to be analyzed at the prima facie stage of this case. As this court is aware, I'm sure, the prima facie standard is a very low burden. And I do think that, at least to supplement the briefs, the recent unpublished decision, TDS, I'm not relying it for purposes of its persuasiveness as to the determination, but it does a really good summary of exploring and describing what is and is not appropriate to be evaluated at the prima facie stage. The reasons that CW believes the district court erred in this case are contained in her brief, but I do want to expand on some of those arguments and perhaps go into more detail with addressing some of the arguments contained in the respondent's brief. When we look at a prima facie determination, the limitations on the district court are that it must consider all allegations in the moving party's affidavit as true and only consider the procedural history and the non-moving party's submissions to the extent that they provide context or explain things. And when we look at this case, the district court evaluated whether the reasons that Min Prairie was unreasonable I guess, effectively did weigh evidence and engaged in an improper weighing of evidence in this case. When we look at the court's order in this case, the determination, and I think the exact word the district court used was that it was dispositive, was the existence of this consent to adopt and what it meant for purposes of the prima facie determination. I did attach to appellant's addendum the consent to adopts that were executed in this matter between the biological parents and the district court at pages 21 through 28. I do think it's critical that the court relied on those consent to adopts themselves in its determination and equated it to a contract, to contract interpretation principles. And so when we are trying to interpret what a contract is, at the very least, there is at least an element of questions of fact there. And CW, in her moving document, set forth that the consent to adopt was unequivocal at page 3, paragraph 4 of each of those consents, that the agency was obligated to pursue alternate placements and consider relatives if the adoption was not finalized within 6 months. And I don't believe that that fact is in dispute in this case. Where the district court—
Do you agree? I mean, my sense is that, you know, the COVID situation and the impact that had on court hearings played some sort of role in this. I mean, there wasn't anything that the foster parents who were the adoptive placement that the parents consented to, that anything they were doing was delaying the ultimate finalization of the adoption, right?
Judge Bjorkman, quite frankly, if we look at, again, keeping in mind we're at the prima facie stage, CW did not offer any evidence or allegations regarding the specific reasons. Simply, it was that the finding wasn't made. So to the extent, which the district court did in this case, come to conclusions and assumptions as to the reasons why the adoption was not finalized, that was error at this stage. Could that have been considered at an evidentiary hearing when the court is weighing all of the evidence? Absolutely. But that's where the district court ultimately erred with that. And
also looking at a rule, I mean, one of the other things the district court, you know, after relying heavily, as you said, on the consents that the parents entered into, I mean, the court also says that CW's motion was not timely because the adoption home study was not filed with on the 30th day the motion. Are you kind of asking this court to excuse that, or is there any case law that would support excusing that filing requirement and considering the merits of the motion?
Your Honor, just to clarify for the record, CW did timely file her motion, a memorandum, and a supporting affidavit.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe you can be very specific. When did the 30 days run? When was the motion filed? And when was the home study filed?
Yes. So the time started running on July 6th. Her motion would have needed to be filed by day 31 days in July. So that would be August 5th. Minnesota was in possession of CW's approved adoption home study August 4th. CW filed her approved adoption home study with her motion the morning of August 6th. And so,
it was a day late. I mean, as I understood it, she filed her motion and attachments timely on August 5th, but the home study she filed the following day. So it was outside of the 30-day period.
And Judge Bjorkman, I do respectfully disagree with that. I am not disputing that it was filed the morning of August 6th, but whether it was untimely is what I specifically take issue with. And if we look, and I have several reasons for that, and certainly I think this is a really important issue. So if I don't get to all of them with other questions, I will address this on rebuttal. First and foremost, when we look at 260C.607, subdivision 6 with those requirements, it required the home study to be filed with her motion. Looking at that definition of with, as was contained in CW's initial brief, with does not require a specific temporal requirement. It needs to be close in time. And so CW's contention is that applying that meaning of with, it was not untimely.
If, and I assume you have alternative arguments, in the event that we disagree with that meaning of with, and we think with means together or at the same time, we were in a peacetime emergency in August of 2020. And the statutory timelines, there is an executive order that addresses the application of those timelines. Are you making any argument that because of that executive order, the 30 days does not preclude filing something on the 31st day?
Your Honor, what I will state to that point, I did not address that issue in my brief. However, the district court did at the very least reference in its order the fact that we were in the COVID-19 pandemic. And what was troubling to say the least in this case is that the district court appears to, and I can get a specific citation to the memorandum that was attached, but said to CW, well, I think you filed this late and I could dismiss it on that reason. But we were in a COVID-19 pandemic. So even though I didn't extend the 6-month timeline that was required under 260C.515 subdivision 3 and was contained in the consent to adopt, that's okay.
I understand how you're arguing, I guess, that the district court relies on the pandemic to excuse one side, but then not the other. My question is more specific, and it is, if there's an executive order that specifically says those statutory deadlines do not preclude or don't apply, essentially, and we look at the statute here, which requires 30 days with and 30 days, are you making any argument that if you file the home study on the 31st day, that the executive order, by operation of the executive order, that is now timely, even if it was on the 31st day? Are you making that argument? Or maybe, can we consider that, even if you're not making it?
Your Honor, for purposes of today, yes. I absolutely agree that that would be relevant to the as an alternative argument if the court did not adopt the analysis of the definition of with and what was required in this case. Before I turn to some of the other issues that have come up under the issue, I think the guardian ad litem's attorney phrased it as standing. I don't really agree with that characterization, but it was included in his brief. We need to, the focus of the case law on motions for adoptive placement and timing, we don't have a whole lot of reported case law. I know Judge Reyes was on the AMF case. I believe I addressed that at least in part in my brief, why that wasn't controlling or dispositive of the issue of standing. But the focus really is on whether the home study is completed in a timely manner. That is the crux of this. And again, it's uncontroverted. CW did have an approved adoption home study in a timely manner. And it's nothing short of a miracle. In the COVID-19 pandemic, she obtained an ICPC adoption home study in less than 1 month. It's unheard of. And I think that when we further look to, you know, as some additional alternative arguments, where I disagree with the unreported case that the guardian ad litem cited, the DK case, that court stated that the statutes are to be strictly construed. And that is actually contrary to the purpose of the Juvenile Court Act that states specifically at 260C.001 that these statutes are to be liberally construed and further the intent is the best interest of the children and to secure timely permanency for children. There's nothing in 260C.607 that states that requires or bars a motion from moving forward. And so I think the language that the district court used with the consent to adopt being dispositive and these other issues being dispositive, as the TDS court just recently addressed, the only thing that is dispositive in these cases is whether is if the prima facie determination was made or if it was not made. That's the only dispositive issue that is at play.
Ms. Stoll, it seems like the district court did at least acknowledge that point, although it really seemed to focus more on the consent issue. And I was wondering if you only have 2 minutes left, if you could really focus on that consent. Why isn't that controlling? And it seems like there's really a little bit of a conflict between the statutes, you know, 260C.607 and 260C.515. If you could address why you believe the district court erred by not considering the arguments and just saying there's a consent here, end of story.
And admittedly, Judge Reyes, there really isn't case law on this issue when there is a consent to adopt. I looked near and far, and perhaps Ms. Henning found something or the court did, but I have not. What I'll say is this. I took great issue at the motion hearing. I took great issue in my brief. This characterization that this was an issue of CW trying to invalidate this consent to adopt. What I really want to emphasize this morning, Your Honors, is that in order for CW to prevail on this prima facie determination, this court and the district court does not have to invalidate or determine that the consent to adopt is unenforceable. Again, taking CW's allegations as true, the agency was required, when the adoption was not finalized within 6 months and without the finding that would extend that, to pursue alternate placements. And Min Prairie refused to do that. That is the crux of CW's argument. And that really needs to be the focus, in my view, of where we are today. Now, looking at 260C.515 and 260C.607 subdivision 7, 515 subdivision 3 refers to reviewing and analyzing and looking for alternate placements. 607 subdivision 7 focuses on actually making that placement determination. And Judge Bryan, I do see my time is up. May I conclude this thought?
Yes, please.
Thank you. And so when we look at 260C.607 subdivision 7, that refers to only one resource being an adoptive placement. And that is a significant definition that is defined in 260C.601. Adoptive placement refers to the agency's ability to make placement decisions. And CW is asking the court to order a specific placement. So when I reconcile them, 515 subdivision 3 says you need to look at other options. 607 subdivision says, whoa, 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 agency. If there is a consent to adopt, the judge needs to be aware of what's going on and make that determination. We don't want you to do that outside of court, as the agency generally does have exclusive authority. So I disagree that there is a conflict in the law with that. I do think both of them have meaning. So I will leave my comments at that and see you back on rebuttal, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Henning.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Sasha Henning. I'm an assistant Steele County attorney and represent the designated responsible human service agency, which is Minnesota Prairie County Alliance, often referred to as Min Prairie. Your Honors, we are here today with a much different fact scenario than what appears to typically come before the court on adoptive placement motions, because this comes before the court out of a consent to adopt. That is much different than an outcome of a termination of parental rights, whether it's a voluntary or involuntary case. The fact that the children in this matter are under the guardianship of the Commissioner of Human Services through a consent to adopt is crucial in this matter and really cannot be ignored in looking at the prima facie case.
Ms. Henning, did Min Prairie assume a duty to look for alternative adoptive placements in your mind?
Following the 6 months, Your Honor?
That's your answer. At the 6 month point, when there hadn't been a court finding that the failure to finalize had something to do with the, okay. So what did your client do then after that 6 month period?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. At the 6 month period was during the COVID-19 pandemic. Our April hearing was canceled. The next hearing was not scheduled until June. At that time, CW, the appellant, requested an expedited ICPC report. The agency requested one day to respond to that to ensure that was the correct report to be filed and to be requested. The expedited ICPC order came out that same day. All the documents were sent to Virginia. We were then the next day informed that it was the wrong request. Within one business day, Mid Prairie then rectified, requesting the corrected ICPC. They had sent, which the appellant agrees, had sent and given medical and mental health records on the children to be able to consider and review. Mid Prairie also began observing visits between the appellant and the children, which appellant concedes in her affidavit was not occurring prior to the 6 month marks, to evaluate whether or not she would be an appropriate placement if at that 12 months, the prospective adoptive parents could not be. Your Honor.
Ms. Henning, you cite some of the things that respondent Mid Prairie did, but I note in your brief that there are some significant delays that occurred, particularly early on, that are not mentioned. And I do want to touch on delays, but before I get that, I wanted to talk about the standard of review. And you note in your brief that the standard of review when a district court has dismissed a motion for adoptive placement, which is what occurred here, there's a three-part standard. One, we review de novo whether or not the district court actually properly treated the party's supporting documents. Two, we look at the district court's determination of whether appellant actually established a prima facie showing, and that's an abuse of discretion standard, and then whether the district court properly determined the need for an evidentiary hearing. And I want to focus on the second part of it, and both parties agree that is the standard that we review. It's our standard of review. On the second one, where did the district court determine whether or not appellant established a prima facie showing by Mid Prairie, by its actions?
Your Honor, it's the standard, in my view, is that the prima facie showing has to be that Mid Prairie was unreasonable and failing to place with the appellant.
Right. Did the district court make that explicit finding by looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to appellant CW?
The district court did adopt numerous findings and statements of the appellant. The district court unfortunately did not make explicit findings of how those don't meet a prima facie standard. And it would be my position to this court that consistent with the JLG case, that if the court finds that the court made an erroneous legal determination, that even with a prima facie case of unreasonableness, that the appellant cannot succeed based on 260C.607. The remedy then is to remand it to the district court to reanalyze the prima facie standards. However, there is significant amounts of information within the appellant's own documents that the fact that they acknowledge that the consent to adopt did exist. But
I want to put that to the side. I want to focus on whether or not, and it sounds like you're conceding that the district court did not, in fact, make a determination as to whether or not appellant, based on accepting her facts and her allegations as true, that it did not make a determination as to whether or not she actually made that prima facie showing. And if that's the case, then aren't we required to reverse and remand to the district court to make that finding?
Your Honor, I would argue twofold. That first, the district court in its alternative arguments later on in its order did go through how even with appellant's facts, there was not a prima facie case because there was no showing that the agency was unreasonable in complying with the consent to adopt in a previous
Let me stop you there, because I know your argument and I know the district court relied on the consent to adopt. I'm more focused on not only the allegations that are made in CW's complaint, which we have to accept as true at this stage, not getting to the merits whether or not they actually are true or not, but we must, as a district court, must accept those as true. But there are allegations of delay by Mint Prairie right from the very beginning. Mint Prairie had been notified January 15th of 2019 that there was that CW was interested as a relative in placement, adoptive placement, had been notified again April 15th and April 22nd, and didn't even contact her until April 26th, which is over 3 months later. That's just one example. There are a lot of delays that are alleged by CW that seem to have affected her ability to be considered as a relative. And case law indicates relative placement is strongly preferred. So why isn't there enough, even before the consent to adopt, to call into question whether or not the Mint Prairie had acted reasonably or not?
Your Honor, I very respectfully understand your question. I think, however, if we were in a termination of parental rights, that would look much, and the children were placed under guardianship that way, that would look much different. We are here under a consent to adopt, where the natural parents chose these prospective adoptive parents to be in the children's best interests. And Minnesota statute 260C.221, which the courts have also relied on in the unpublished case of DD, relative notifications do not apply when a child is placed with an appropriate relative or foster home that is committed to adopting the child. So I think that can also be applied for the consent to adopt.
If I can just stop you, I want to make sure I understand, and this goes back to a question I asked earlier. From what point in the record do we judge Mint Prairie's efforts to consider other adoption placements? Did they have the obligation to do so before the permanency order in, when was that, December of 2019?
Your Honor, the agency always has requirements to consider relatives for concurrent placement. The appellant does concede in her affidavit that there were a number of relatives under the process, that her ICPC was under process. So certainly that own concession is in place. Then at the time of the consent to adopt, it's our position that 260C.607 applies. So there is not the ability to make an alternative placement. In February of 2020, Mint Prairie was relieved of any additional relative search efforts due to the consent to adopt that had never been then reinstated at any time. And then following the 6 months, Mint Prairie then did make the efforts to consider appellant. However, it's also our position that although we did not have the specific language required in 260C.515 subdivision 3.7, that certainly the court could have made that finding based on all of the facts that were already before the court, including the foster parents had signed an adoption placement agreement. All of the documents were with Minnesota Department of Human Services. They had found that the placement was appropriate and in the children's best interest. So certainly all of the factors were available for the court to make the finding that is required at 6 months. And it is our position that that was just an oversight, that finding was not made, that it should have been made, that failure to make that finding should not be detrimental in considering the best interests of the children. Because the court had found that the agency was pursuing the agreement as allowed under the consent to adopt. And the fact that there was not a 6-month review hearing given the COVID-19 pandemic.
Given that, and I don't disagree with that, isn't it also reasonable to construe the CW's filing of the home study one day late to be timely, given all of the circumstances of the COVID pandemic and suspensions of various statutory and other filing deadlines?
Your Honor, I do agree that would also apply to appellant. We did file a motion as one of the bases asking because it was untimely. Clearly, in looking at the guardian ad litem's report and reviewing the DK case, the plain language is that it has to be filed with. It's our position supported that that has to be contemporaneous. The DK court looked at that fairness has merit, but it's not overwhelming. But we also acknowledge that the other case law surrounding filing the motion and home study together also is recognizing they want agencies to have the documents before the hearings. It is not the sole basis that we ask the district court to dismiss the motion on. And so I do believe also that one day late having the pandemic in place also should apply to the appellant as well.
Ms. Henning, I want to come back to, if I understand you correctly, it sounds like you are acknowledging that we can look at the entire record for what the agency is doing, because the agency has an ongoing obligation to act and look at relative placement as a priority, among other things. But I want to go back to the whole idea of the prima facie case, whether or not one has been established, and the district court not making a determination as to whether a prima facie case. An agency also has an obligation to consider placement with a relative under Minnesota Statute 260C.221A, quote, without delay. So why aren't the facts alleged by CW sufficient to establish at least a prima facie case that the agency acted unreasonably because it did not act without delay?
Because appellant also does cite within their affidavit and supporting documents that immediately following the children's removal, that the agency was requesting names of relatives from BW that could serve as placement.
And Ms. Henning, just to be clear, I'm talking about throughout the entire, from January on, not just after the consent, but the actions that it took or did not take before.
Certainly. So at the outset of the child protection matter, when the children were placed in October 9th of 2018, the appellant states within their affidavit that the agency immediately began reaching out and looking for relatives through BW, that she received information that she could be a placement in January, and that came from a paternal relative. So certainly appellant is acknowledging the agency was also working with paternal relatives. Then in their conversation in April, she was able to give Minnesota Prairie County Alliance information, that referral was made then on June 6th, that there were other ICPCs that were pending. She acknowledges that. She acknowledges throughout her affidavit that the parents continued to explore relative placements through November. So the appellant does acknowledge that Minn Prairie was making efforts. Appellant does assert in her affidavit that those efforts were not with her. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I do see that I'm out of time, if I may finish my thought.
You may, go ahead.
She does acknowledge within her affidavit that Minn Prairie was making efforts with relatives, but not with her. However, she also states that her ICPC was pending and that given the ICPC law, she could not be a placement at that time. So within appellant's own asserted facts to the court, she is acknowledging numerous different relatives that the agency was working with, and that she had a very consistent contact from April until November with the agency as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Stoll, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to start by addressing this relative issue and reasonable efforts, and Min Prairie's argument is that they were pursuing other relatives, and that's what made their actions reasonable. But it requires them to pursue all relatives that are known to them. And as Ms. Henning just acknowledged, they did not diligently pursue CW. They diligently pursued other relatives, some of whom were going through the ICPC process and waiting to resolve the permanency file. But they didn't wait for CW. Why? That's a question that would need to be addressed at the evidentiary hearing. Again, with where we're at in the case right now, a lot of these questions are going to be properly before the district court and not this court. But CW did not concede in any fashion that simply looking at other relatives satisfied their obligation. So I want to make that clear. Next, I disagree with Min Prairie that the consent to that permanency achieved, whether it's through a consent to adopt or a termination, impacts any duties or procedures post-permanency. All of those matters still flow under the same subdivisions of Chapter 260C. So I don't see that being a particularly relevant or persuasive distinction with what the Min Prairie's duties are. And I also appreciate Ms. Henning acknowledging that, you know, if the COVID pandemic cuts both ways, or it needs to cut both ways, I do want to acknowledge, as the record reflects in this case, that CW did, within minutes, and I think it was about 30 minutes, filed the approved adoption home study. Min Prairie filed its motion objecting and requesting dismissal 5 minutes later. It didn't get prepared in 5 minutes. And I think that that is also significant, and it is within the record when we're looking at evaluating the context that was provided and the explanations that were provided. Since I didn't get to delve into it too deeply, I do want to go through specifically that was lacking from the district court's order, how CW has established a prima facie case quite overwhelmingly. First, the fact that the district court applied Chapter 259 in the bulk of its analysis and case law that interprets Chapter 259, I think is a concern, is an error in and of itself, as 259 does not apply for children who are under the guardianship of the Commissioner of Human Services. That's Chapter 260C that applies. Next, the district court, as I indicated before, really placed the burden on CW to demonstrate unreasonableness in the decision making and improperly shifted that burden to her, something that was acknowledged and explored, at least in a little bit of detail, in the unreported TDS case. And further, erred when it determined, and this is also a significant factor, yes, the purpose of the prima facie determination is to look at unreasonableness, but part of unreasonableness can certainly be, were the children's best interests the paramount consideration? Min Prairie conceded it did not conduct a best interest analysis of the placement factors with regard to CW. There's conflicting information in the record that was attached to CW's submissions with whether that analysis ever occurred. First, they said it did in September. Then there was a letter added in July 2020 that it hadn't been done before they received the initial foster care home study. But it's troubling that in this case that Min Prairie believes they should be able to move forward with this when they acknowledge themselves they haven't even respected the paramount consideration in all child protection proceedings, which is the best interest of the child. And when we look at unreasonableness, Your Honors, I do want to note the unreasonableness started with not only at the very beginning of this case, delaying looking at CW and evaluating her as a placement option. It continued after she received an approved foster care home study. It occurred after they received the approved adoption home study before CW's motion was due. And all of those signify violations of Minnesota law when it comes to the agency's obligations. I want to conclude, Your Honors, with simply stating that by reversing and remanding, this does not guarantee that CW's motion is going to be granted. all CW is asking is that this court to determine she did meet the relatively low burden of standard of proof in this matter, and that she has the right to present her case in full. And only after that would the district court make, would it be appropriate for the district court to make the determinations it made in its order denying her motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your arguments, both of you, and your and all the briefs. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory time frame.